What's the difference between noise and sound? I'm Mike Waters at National Public Radio in Washington. On this edition of Options, you'll be building sound with an instrument maker, an acoustician, a recording engineer, performers, teachers, and your own ears. Where do we start? Our engineer, Jim Anderson, who's looking at me from the control room right now, is about to start the program by taking us to Agnes Frommer in the woods of West Virginia.
I was listening to music, listening to the radio, and decided to take a walk out into the country, out into the woods that I'm very familiar with. I've grown up here, and I know what the sounds are like. It's been snowing. There's lots of snow on the ground. And hear the noises it makes when I move my weight in it. Different kinds of crunching noises. There's a stream that runs through the woods. In the wintertime, the water is covered with ice. And now it's beginning to thaw. The spring is beginning to come. I can hear the ice beginning to crack apart. When you get closer to it, when you kneel down and almost try to put your ears to the water, how you can almost feel in a way. It's not really feeling, but it's almost like as if you can feel the sound. The water's moving over rocks and little stones and small pebbles. And the trees moving. When I listen to the sounds in the woods, sounds of the river, the trees, the birds. And then I think of the sounds that I hear on my record player and the music that comes from the radio. I wonder what the difference is, if there is a difference, between music and the natural sounds. Like the sound of the ice now, it's not exactly like a musical instrument, but it's as particular as a particular musical instrument might be, like a flute. And I wonder if it's just all the same phenomenon.
Melody and the harmony as the piece progresses, as the music progresses, that certainly is appealing to your brain in some way. If you look at it on an oscilloscope, or if you analyze it by some other means, you will find a musical tone is periodic. The noise typically is not periodic, and the crossings along the x-axis will be irregular. It's a random, jagged, higgledy-piggledy sort of signal. So that is one important difference. There's another way of representing a musical sound, and that is by considering its energy spectrum. And there's an important difference there between the musical tone and the noise. That is that the musical tone has what we call a line spectrum. That is, the energy is not distributed over all frequencies, but only at a few. So for the musical tone, the energy spectrum is a line spectrum, but for the noise signal, or the noise, the energy is a broadband, has a broadband spectrum, or as we say, a continuous spectrum. That means there's energy at all frequencies, and that is why the brain cannot generally ascribe one particular pitch. You may say, well, that's a high frequency noise or a low frequency noise, but typically you can't prescribe an exact or a close pitch.
Not perfectly in tune. That's a concord if we play C and C sharp.
We do seem to find a struggle between the two notes where you play two a semitone apart. And one reason given for this is that the brain is trying to somehow relate, or it's trying to take in and record both of these notes, and they have no similarities, so it has to do a lot of work to embrace them both, so to speak. This is not really a complete argument, but I think it's on the right lines. I think I, like most other people, adjust my brain somehow. The brain does it by itself, and so I enjoy music on my car radio almost as much as I enjoy it on my, quote, hi-fi here, which certainly has better sound quality. It's not perfect, of course, but it's a lot better than the car radio. But I think you make an adjustment. What is this thing you do in the theatre? You suspend disbelief, don't you? I think when you're listening to your car radio, you tell yourself, well, they're playing a very nice piece of music. I'm not going to listen to the defects and the faults. I'm going to enjoy the mastery of the composer, the melody and the harmony and so on. I think I would enjoy it more if the quality were better, but perhaps 10% more. But I still like to listen to something good when I'm driving home. I think there's also a problem, too, that it's sometimes felt that people can't tell the difference anyway. They're so used to hearing all kinds of music, they're used to hearing their radio and television, and can they really tell one conductor from another, or one orchestra from another, or a hall with good acoustics from a hall with bad acoustics? A scientist has devised a machine which will blow wind instruments, like a trumpet. And this is a fairly new development. And this way you can get an objective test of two different trumpets or 10 different trumpets, and then you can measure the tone quality, or you can play the tones to an audience of trumpeters and say, now this is trumpet A, B, C, D, E. Which do you think is the highest quality, and which would you buy? And the results were fascinating. One very cheap trumpet, they all said, was much better than one very expensive trumpet. And he was very amused because he was a scientist, you see, and he said, to show you how influenceable some musicians are, I got them and I recorded exactly what they said, you see, and then next week I invited them back and he repeated it, and they said the same. The third week, he brought them back, and he then took the labels off the trumpets. He showed them the trumpet. He said, now this is this one which has a marvelous reputation as a trumpet. And he said, I think he had five trumpeters there. And he said, 4 out of 5 said, oh, well, they must have made some mistake before. It couldn't be that that didn't sound as good as this one over here. And so he laughed at this and he said, well, you see, they couldn't believe their own, the judgment of their ears, because they were so indoctrinated, is too strong a word, but their brains didn't want to reconcile this with their preconceived idea of how good this make was.
If I can tell the difference between musical sounds and sounds that are just considered noise, then I should be able to build an instrument, a device, that can produce that sound, that particular kind of musical sound.
I have here in front of me an original native version of the kalimba, or African piano, as we call it here. When I was in East Africa a few years ago, I saw the way the natives use whatever they can find, soda bottle tops, and they put them on their kalimbas. Any piece of metal or scrap that they can, they use as a percussion instrument over there. This is the primitive version. And we have the more modern version, which is exported and become a very popular instrument. We have here a serpent, which is an instrument that literally looks like a snake. It's made out of one piece of wood that's hollowed out and curved like a coiled snake. This instrument that sort of looks like a candy cane, except that it's not striped, is called a crumb horn. I think that everybody's comment might be, after they hear it, that they know why it's called the crumb horn. I'm going to go to sound over. I had a beautiful sound a moment ago. Wait 1 second. This one is $230. Now, today, the professionals that come in want very powerful instruments. The size of our concert halls are large, and the orchestras are large, and they have to have instruments that can play over them. As time goes on, the instrument makers seem to be trying to achieve in their instruments a much more powerful sound. They're trying to achieve power, even over quality of sound.
You have to figure back around 1575, 1580, is when the modern violin in its present form came into being. And essentially it hasn't changed one bit. And you'll find guitars and a lot of things, lutes have gone through some changes. But the whole purpose behind the violin, and I really got to get my history books out for this. This was a long time ago when I read that, and I think it's long forgotten, but court, the count, or whatever, of the Italian court down in Cremona at the time, wanted, or possibly this was for the Pope. Things are coming back to me now, but possibly this was for the Pope. But they wanted in the choir an instrument that would assimilate the human voice. And Da Sala went about his work, and this is what he came up with. And it's been the closest thing A string instrument is the closest thing so far to the human voice, so that's the way it works. This week sold a cello to Rostropovich. I shouldn't tell you the price, but he bought a beautiful, beautiful Viom cello. He's investing in instruments. He may have a twofold purpose, one for investment purpose, but also a tax shelter because it's business related. And they're great investments, by the way. They really are. You say diamonds, you know, you people say, oh gosh, you bought diamonds, but you know, diamonds aren't going to go up or anything. Fiddles go up so quickly. It's ridiculous. If Isaac Stern gets a particular fiddle from one maker, and if he plays a fiddle by Beziak, this would be something that's reasonably affordable by a majority of people. These are $4,000 or $5,000. He's got a great Guarneri. He probably wouldn't, but if he did and it sounded great, people would probably really seek those Beziaks out. However, you take 10 Beziaks, and there's going to be two or three that I would consider good. He might have gotten a good one, but somebody may buy that 7th through 1st Beziak, the ones that don't sound so well, just because he's so pleased with it. See, and you can't go by that. You really have to go by each individual. You have each individual instrument. You have to take into account its individual qualities and sound.
There is a considerable difference between different cellists playing on the same instrument, for example. And when I pick up this marvelous instrument in the next room, I just try to imagine what it would sound like if Rostropovich, for example, were playing it, because he manages to find the center of the tone and bring it out, and he can make it just a huge sound, and it's marvelous. But the other problem when you're trying out a new instrument, for example, is the beginning student has no idea how awful he sounds, or at least he's willing to put up with it. This is why it's so marvelous to start in second, third, or fourth grade, that the kid will have a satisfaction in playing his assignment, and he's learning a tremendous amount physically. He's training his fingers, he's training his ear, he's training every part of his body to play the instrument without being horrified at the sound that he's making. And for example, an adult, or say a college student starting the instrument, he starts it because he already knows what Rostropovich sounds like, and he says, I want to play like that. And he's not going to be able to play something that even he can listen to for a year. And for him to even approach some kind of beautiful sound and technical virtuosity is going to take him years, and he's aware the whole time of what he sounds like. So it takes a tremendous force of will for an adult to learn the instrument. And he doesn't have the built-in skills either. I mean, it feels foreign when you pick up the cello the first time. The bow does not lie in your hand as it looks like it should. I mean, you watch a cellist play and the bow looks like it's glued to his fingers. But I think anyone could play well enough to make themselves happy with the basic equipment that all human beings are given. And I'm absolutely positive that you could have somebody who could be an excellent cellist with three fingers. The body is that flexible. If you want to do it badly enough, you'll find a way.
I remember being especially fascinated with the sound of drums. I think I liked the physical activity. I think I liked the excitement. And I can remember the first time that I got a chance to play the drums. I really f- felt intrigued with the whole problem of getting my wrists to work right so that I could get the kind of drum roll that was needed. And when I would bend over it to play it, I can feel now how that was, and it was really as if my whole body was a part of it, part of making that sound. And how, again, difficult it was to get my hands to do what I wanted them to do, to create the kinds of sounds I had in my head that I wanted to come out of that musical instrument.
As a traditional student, I can remember experiences when guests would come to the house and mother and dad would ask me to please get my violin and play a piece for them. And my answer would almost always be, well, I haven't quite learned my new piece and I've already forgotten my last piece, so I haven't got anything to play. And my parents' reaction would be, well, you've been playing the violin for 4 years. And we're paying all this money and driving you all over the county to get all your good experiences in music, and you can't even play a simple piece for your aunt and uncle when they come. I've seen stage fright with any of my students. We don't talk about nerves. We talk about being excited, and usually, especially if a child is playing a solo on a performance, I will take the violin from the child just before the solo and check the tuning. If it's a beginning student, if it's an advanced student, they do their own. And my last words are not remember the up bow, remember the down bow, remember the dynamics, but my parting words to them are, have a good time. Have fun with this piece. The children all learn the same repertory. And this makes it possible for my oldest student, who is currently 14, to play with my youngest student, who isn't quite 3. Suzuki students will have at their command on a moment's notice a vast repertoire of pieces that they can stand up and play. And they are accustomed to memorizing everything they play in performance, and they don't even need music. To me, music is a tool, as a teacher, anyway. Dr. Suzuki's idea about using, and he literally is using, the violin or the cello or the piano to teach a child, his purpose is to make these young children be beautiful souls. And music is a tool to that. It's all of the best things in human relations involved in the lesson and in the practice. And the end result should be, as Dr. Suzuki would say, playing from the heart.
I had a student who was 8 at the time I got him, very talented young boy, and I was so impressed with him that I felt rather than teach him traditional drums and percussion music, that I'd let him sit behind a drum set and I would play the piano, and I would let this student play whatever he felt was appropriate behind the piano. Well, the first time I played with him, he fitted right in. Within a few measures, he was playing time. He was playing good color, a nice tone and dynamics behind me. So from that time on, my teaching involved essentially sitting at the piano and playing while he played behind me. And I would play anything that came into my mind in any complex time signature that I could execute, and he would simply fit right in. He was very fluid, very dynamic. I could shift times on him, say from a standard 4-4 to a 3-4 into a 6-8 time or a 7-8 time, and he would just flow right along. Our lessons went on for some time. My student became interested at that point in composition and began to write small things for his school orchestra. And then one day, his father came along to sit in on the lesson. He sat there quite sullenly, didn't say much of anything. We went through our lesson, which to his ears must have sounded kind of left-wing music, I suppose. He picked his son up and took him home, and the following week, the boy didn't show up. His father showed up, and he said that he had decided that I had cheated his son because he had put him to the test and he had failed. Well, I asked him what he meant. He said that he had taken his son to a music store, and the owner of the store took him into the back room and put up a drum book, I suppose it was an elementary book, counted off a very rapid tempo, and the boy became nervous and couldn't accomplish anything that was on the page, went into tears, and that was it. He was taken out of my care at that point and apparently put in the hands of the guy who freaked him out at the music store.
My memories of my first piano teacher are very much linked with the room in which I had my piano lesson. It was definitely designed for the piano lesson. It was a small room with enough room for just the piano and a few chairs, and there were a lot of busts of Beethoven and Brahms. And the piano teacher was a very gentle kind of person who was also very quick to let you know that what you were doing was to be taken very seriously. And that the time of the lesson was a very special time. There was almost a ceremony to it. And the listening and the playing, the physical and the mental kind of structure, our feelings, all come together so that the physical part is important, mental part is important, and the feelings you have about how those work together are all important too.
Tend to think in classical music in terms of maybe the Germanic-Austrian axis, where we speak in terms of motives like ta-ta-ta-ta, ta-ta-ta-ta, something like that, that will certainly identify itself with a calling card, as Debussy said, when it comes back. We think of Mozart, for instance, a sonata or a concerto, which is so close to his opera thinking, or sonatas in general, that the themes are characters in a way. The total theme, the whole four-bar theme, the song is, well, they used to call it the boy and the girl, you know, that kind of thing, whatever. But you could think of it as Zerlina, and you could think of it as Figaro, whatever. And they had their embroilments, and sometimes they don't get a chance to talk very much, and sometimes they talk together. And I think probably this personification of themes was very much a manner, part of Mozart's style. And we remember by the character coming back. Well, this is cantabile, this is singing, in other words, or this is heroic or gruff or abrupt. And by mixing the characters, we can follow the action. But then with a man like Beethoven, for instance, right on the after sun glow of that period, you have a man approaching drama as an inner drama of different moods or temperaments, psychodrama, if you will, in his own self, where the, let's say, bold, the aggressive, is matched by the faint or the yielding, and intermixtures of the two that are identified as the same personality by being maybe the same rhythmic motive, or in the same key, or in the same group of themes. I think he brought something terribly important into the world. In that sense, he didn't so much free the sonata, but he made it go underground and solve its own problems inside. And then when we have Debussy, we have a life of the senses, it seems, like a drama of the senses, the passing moods of the, well, he called one of them Sounds and Perfumes, turning in the air of evening, his response to the impinging of the various senses, and how it can be very dramatic, because it can be an interruption. A bad smell can be very interruptive sometimes, or a beautiful smell in the same way to whatever your quiet mood had been. Maybe it's the life of the nervous system. It's just an interesting thing. Well, the ear is a membrane, and it does divide the outside from the inside. of our brain, and it has to be stroked by vibrations. Sound is a very, very fine form of touch. I think we are recognizing that our senses cooperate, and they always have, to give many, many pathways of information to the central brain. Maybe this is where the form of sounds is leading to, is as a kind of, cooperation with the other senses to get to the very heart center without means of grammar, without means of formalisms.
Now, Gassiri was a great hero. Every day he went into battle. Every day he fought against his enemies. Every day he won. And his fame was great. And all his sons fought beside him, and they were great heroes.
Ho, dira gana gana sila, hufasa. Ho, dira gana gana sila, hufasa.
But one day, Gassiri was walking in the forest, and he heard a bird singing. Gassiri crept up close and listened. A partridge sat under a bush and sang, "Hear my song, hear my deeds." The partridge sang of its battles with the snake. The partridge sang, "All creatures must die and be buried. Kings and heroes die and are buried. I too shall die, but the song of my battles will live. My song shall outlast all the kings and heroes. Ho, that I might do great deeds. Ho, that I may sing. Ho, my song shall live. Ho, dear Agana Gana Sila, Hufasa. Ho, dear Agana Gana Sila, Hufasa." Gassiri went to the old wise man.
"Listen," he said. "I was in the forest. I understood the partridge. The partridge boasted that its song would live forever. Make me a lute." "I will," the old man said. "But the lute will not sing." "Do your work," Gassiri said.
The wise old man made the lute and brought it to Gassiri, and he struck on the lute, but the lute did not sing.
"Look here," Gassiri said. "The lute does not sing. Make it sing." "It is only a piece of wood," the wise man said. "You must give it a heart. Carry it on your back when you go into battle. The wood must ring with the stroke of your sword. It must be blood of your blood, breath of your breath. Then your heart will live on in this piece of wood." Gassiri called his seven sons. Gassiri said, "My sons, today we do battle. Today the strokes of our sword will ring for the ages. You and I, my sons, will live on beyond all the other heroes."
"Ho, dear Gana Gana Sila, Hufasa. Ho, dear Gana Gana Sila, Hufasa."
Then Gassiri and his oldest son went into battle. Gassiri wore the lute on his back. All day they fought. They fought like heroes. But as the sun went down, Gassiri's oldest son fell dead, a spear through his heart. Gassiri took the body of his son up on his back and slowly struggled home. And the heart's blood of his oldest son dropped onto the lute which was hanging on Gassiri's back. Gassiri mourned. That night he took his lute and struck against the wood. The lute did not sing. He called his sons and said, "Tomorrow we ride again."
"Ho, dear Gana Gana Sila, Hufasa. Ho, dear Gana Gana Sila, Hufasa."
For 7 days, Gassiri rode into battle. Every day, one of his sons went with him to be first in the line of battle. And on every one of these days, Gassiri carried the body of one of his sons over his shoulder and over the lute back to the campfire. And on every evening, the blood of his sons dripped onto the lute.
"Ho, dear Gana Gana Sila, Hufasa. Ho, dear Gana Gana Sila, Hufasa."
But after the 7 days of fighting, there was a great sorrow in the village. All the women wailed. All the men were angry. The old wise man called the tribe together and said, "Gassiri, this must stop. We fight when we have to, but you have no limit. The rest of us are more inclined to life than fame. We do not wish to die without fame, but we have no wish to live for fame alone."
"Oh, dear Aganaganasila, Ufasa. Oh, dear Aganaganasila, Ufasa."
Then Gassiri left his people and rode into the desert alone. He rode far, day and night, and at night he rested in the loneliness. He sat by the fire. He sat there a long time, not sleeping. Suddenly, he jumped up. Gassiri listened. Close beside him, Gassiri heard a voice. It rang as though it came from himself. It was the lute. He heard the lute. The lute began to sing.
When I invented the phonograph on August 12, 1877, a number of practical applications occurred to me. First of all, letter writing and all kinds of dictation without the aid of a stenographer. Phonographic books which will speak to blind people without effort on their part. The teaching of elocution. The family record, a registry of sayings, reminiscences, etc., by members of a family in their own voices, and of the last words of dying persons. Clocks that should announce in articulate speech the time for going home, going to meals, etc. Connection with the telephone, so as to make that instrument an auxiliary in the transmission of permanent and invaluable records, instead of being the recipient of momentary and fleeting communication. The preservation of languages by exact reproduction of the manner of pronouncing, and I suppose, reproduction of music.
It's an understatement to say that things have come a long way since Edison's time. In fact, that's a drastic understatement. I hate to think of what it might be like 50 years from now, because we'll probably seem very primitive compared to what we're doing today. But can you imagine what might happen 50 years from now? I mean, it's just... Well, it's an understatement to say that...
Now, what we've got here is this is
a long way since
what we recorded before, and... The easiest thing I can do to show you, to open up perspective, is just to turn in some reverb.
I hate to think of what it might be like 50 years from now.
We're just entering that signal into the reverb and then bringing it back. That's just a chamber with some springs in it that rattle around and then bring it up, and it has a delay sound. And we can even...
Just to look at the advances.
We can remove our signal, and that's just the sound of the reverb right there. Well, we're in Studio One at National Public Radio, and it's the largest of our three studios that we have. As you can see in the studio proper there, it's got movable walls. They can turn, and you turn the walls and get a little livelier sound. The musicians like that. They like to hear themselves coming back at themselves.
There's nothing in the world prettier than singing. Me, I don't know too much about music, but
good.
My heart's desire is to live and sing like you people are singing, that are trying with all your hearts, Lord, to teach me how to sing. I've sung before you lots of times and seen the tears rolling down your cheeks.
Are you getting the spirit in the dark? Are you getting the spirit in the dark? Mm-hmm. People moving, they tell me we're grooving. Just getting the spirit, getting it in the dark.
It always does feel like night in here. Very dark, very cave, because in this room is completely isolated from the rest of the building. It's floating on all kinds of substances to make it isolated from vibration and from extraneous noise that might happen. There are doors that close solid and noise won't go through them. We're going to run out of tape. You think it's funny we couldn't continue our conversation until we put up more tape? let me try this. Now we're listening into the cue speaker. Okay. This record says it's a sports car interior. I have on the other turntable, on my left, a record with chimpanzees on it. We'll put up on the board our sports car. And we'll put the chimpanzees inside the sports car. And that's just playing two records and putting them into a mixing console. And we can... we've been able to take music tracks and just shorten them down. The funniest thing was one time when we were just playing and took a Liszt overture that was about 6 minutes long and cut it down to 32 seconds, and it was a cut every four measures, and it just trunked the whole thing right down. It sounded awful, and it made no musical sense whatsoever, but it worked, but it shouldn't have at all.
I didn't intend to be a musician, and I had some encouragement or discouragement from my family about being a musician. They thought that this was not really a career that you could enjoy. My father assumed that they all hated their conductors and they didn't get paid enough, and they were worried about their fingers. And musicians serve the longest apprenticeship of any craftsman, you know. And for me, at the moment, it seems the better the money, the less musical experience you get out of this. We're sort of sitting in the background, sweetening the sound of the brass for recording sessions, where you sweeten up the background for a disco group, and you get paid an outrageous amount of money for 3 hours' work for a totally unmusical experience. You never see you never hear the performance, you never hear the record, you don't even know one from the next. It's, say, six or eight strings sitting in a room, and the monitor will play a rhythm track and a drum track, which has already been laid down. And we go through and put down our tracks, and then next week they call in the horns, and a week after that they call in the kazoo and the harpsichord, and at some future date, somewhere else in the world, they'll put on the vocals or something. You know, it's really a manufacturing process, and it's a little bit like being an assembly line worker for a musician.
And when you end up becoming a technician, you listen to things for different reasons than someone else who is a producer would, or a musician would. You're listening for the quality of the sound and for the absence or presence of noise or distortion or other things. And especially in dealing with radio and communications, the key is intelligibility. How fast can I understand? How fast can I connect with what you've just given to me over the radio, or as far as music, or as far as speech, or whatever? And I find it frustrating. In fact, a lot of times don't listen to records or radio or television just because of either the poor production that people sitting behind consoles like this do, or poor editing, people cutting the tapes, things like that. In fact, that's a drastic understatement. I hate to think of what it might be like 50 years from now, because we'll probably seem very primitive compared to what we're doing today.
Radio stations program music in a certain way, I'm sure. The classical music stations put, you know, short, bright pieces on in the morning, and rock stations really hit you with the lively cuts. Well, I program my whole day musically, mostly emotionally. And so in the morning, I feel real good about the day, and I put on a nice, happy piece of music. But sometimes I really have to rock in the morning. I really have to hear a nice piece of hard rock and roll. And when I get home after a day's work and I'm real tired, and then I have to go out again, well then, a real strong piece of show music or a real strong piece of rock to get me going again. So I sort of program myself musically.
After 7 there, 62 degrees in New York, and let's see, I played that there for Janice and Tom, Donna and Pucky, Pam and Wayne, and all the kids over there at Terrace Avenue, and we've stopped taking calls for the BMR correspondence because, wow, we're just backlogged. And Tom Seaton of the Franklin School let us know they beat Aaron in softball 15-1, 16 victories for a 2-year period. Nutty! And we have a name and a claimer winner there, Jackie Chastel of Forest Hills, a namer and claimer winner on that first call from Queens, and she won Baby It's You by the Shirelles.
I sing in the car. If I'm listening to the radio in the car, I really sing. I mean, that is when I really let loose. Sometimes in the shower, but not very much. I just can really get into it. And I don't care if I'm driving down the road, and I know sometimes if I stop at a light, it probably looks a little strange, because people can see your mouth moving, but they can't hear anything coming out of it. You know? But what the heck? I know I don't have a really good voice, and so when I'm alone in the car, who is it hurting?
I do let my mind wander when I'm listening to music. I'm not listening intently and following the score and things like that. For instance, almost every time when I'm listening to Sibelius, for instance, I'm thinking of frozen landscapes or wishing for them. I remember once particularly hearing a performance on records of the Sibelius Violin Concerto when I was in the middle of the Red Sea. And it was midnight. It was something like 95 degrees even at that time. It still hadn't cooled down. And I thought how wonderful it would be to feel physically some of that cool that must have surrounded the composer when he was making that score in the first place.
Once you've studied music, you hear music and a lot of sounds that other people would think is unmusical. You'll hear construction workers and be able to pick out a 3 or 4 notes from the clang of their instruments or whatever they use that you'll recognize from a piece. And you'll hear tones on elevators and know if they've played a third or a fifth or what they've played. It's usually through sound association. When a car or something reminds me of another sound I've heard, you make the connection.
My girl, we did the same thing, but she might not buy it, whereas I'll be so thrilled with it. I'll buy it and play it to death. But when just about, I'd say 12:30 at night, when no one's up, and, you know, I fantasize with being a DJ or something like that, and I just play what I want as long as I want. And it's just, it's really, really nice, you know.
I don't like to listen to music in the morning. I very much do not like being awakened to music. Music's more serious than what I'm able to give or bring to it first thing in the morning. When I think of noise and a definition of noise, I think of a blend of sounds. Traffic, jackhammers, children screaming in the street. Those different kinds of sounds do not have a harmony, do not have a mixing with each other that has any intentionality to it at all. But there are rock songs that sound like noise to me too, and when I hear them blasting from the houses down the street, drive me crazy. And if they are loud enough and continuous enough, I will go knock on a door and say, will you please turn your music off?
You walk down along the road and the ambient sound around you is no longer just ambient sound, it's a soundtrack. It's a record, it's a symphony. You know, it's not that it's loud or that it's, you know, there are certain harmonies that takes on an abstract meaning in your head. And that can be music. I mean, that's music. Go out and find a girl. Come on, dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be all right. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer in the city. Summer in the city.
If you turn off the radio and then start listening to the sounds around you and stop labeling them, can they become musical?
The fish does. The bird does. The monkey does. The bird flies away. It flies, it flies, it flies. Goes, returns, passes, climbs. And drops, and drops, and drops. I act the bird. All lives, all dances, and all is loud. The fish does. The bird does. The monkey does. All lives, all dances, and all is loud.
Building Sound was written and produced by Larry Massett and Keith Talbot. The technical director was Jim Anderson, with technical assistance by Bob Nock. This program was made possible with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For Options, I'm Mike Waters, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.